This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And you know, it's just exhausting to listen to some sentimental dum-dum prattle on with patronizing identitarian twaddle, especially
that's the word of the day, by the way, twaddle. I love it.
Especially if you're a mayor who, when she ran for office, described herself as a triple threat, quote-unquote, which I have obliged by making in her moniker, she being a triple threat because she is a black female lesbian. So you can understand the frustration in having to endure the tripe from an alderman like Rosanna Rodriguez. You can understand it.
I really hope that as lawmakers and people committed to transformation, we will be able to continue to fight for a more equitable, a more just, a more a space where we can all be free, a space where Black people feel safe, a space where we can all thrive. And that starts with the liberation of Black people. Until that happens, none of us will be free. I'm very grateful for the contributions of all Black people that have come before. And I'm really thankful for all my colleagues and all the Black people that have contributed to make this city a better place for all. Thank you, Madam.
You gotta be f-ing kidding me. Thank you, Alderwoman. The chair recognizes Alderman Jim Gardner.
You gotta be effing kidding me. Yeah, welcome to the party, Mayor Lightfoot, or should I term you triple threat? Now, a lot of people didn't catch this follow-up exchange she had after the...
Oh, what is it?
You got to be effing kidding me. This is the exchange between 33rd Ward Alderman, who you heard there at the outset, Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez, who beat Deb Mel, and Mayor Lightfoot right after that little exchange. Here it is.
I love Black people!
I love Black people!
Who's your motherfucker, Jerry?
You, my motherfucker!
What you gonna do, Jerry?
Show me the money!
I don't know why she referred to her as Jerry, the mayor. Maybe that's a pet name we don't know about.
Her office, excuse me, claims that she wasn't directing that comment towards Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez, that they were discussing something else. So, she's not paying attention then to the alderman? See, our positivity rate is so low, Dan, that they need to go back to City Hall. I'm done with these Zoom city council meetings. You know, but that's
who
an ancillary
cares
issue. But
where they converse, who
because
the
she
hell
is hiding
cares?
From the media and she's hiding from aldermen who confront her. She's a dictator.
She's not hiding from Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez. She just said, you got to be effing kidding me what she has to say.
She's so tough.
Here's the thing about Lori Lightfoot that, you wouldn't understand if you didn't pay close attention. If you didn't have some appreciation for what actually, the actual beliefs, which sometimes she lets slip because it's so exasperating to deal with morons like Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez, who, by the way, is a DSA, D33rd Ward DSA, Democrat Socialist of America. She's one of our out and proud socialist aldermen. And you can hear the quality of her intellect in that offering to emancipate Black people in Chicago. It's wonderful. When does that start? The thing about Lightfoot, she doesn't like the identitarian politics, except when it cynically serves her interests. She doesn't buy this stuff. She listens to that. Listen to some 2-bit socialist like Rodriguez Sanchez, who doesn't know up from down, carry on about how she's going to emancipate Black people, how she loves Black people. Thank you, all the Black people, Black people, Black people, Black people.
Black History Month. It's wrapping up soon.
Lightfoot despises that. But she's happy to exploit it when it serves her interest. That's how cynical and, frankly, Machiavellian that she is.
I remember one time we had her on the show. I said, how do you want to be introduced? She says, a lesbian, female, then black. I'm like, okay, so not female. I mean, if you're a lesbian, aren't you female? Anyway, but whatever. Okay, we'll do that.
You understand intersectionality scores. You get one for gender. You get one for orientation. You get one for race.
Yep.
You maybe get another one for a disability. I mean, that's the game. And that's what it is, a game. So why would you be cowered by either side of that ridiculous exchange?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
All they have is to play race and gender and sexual orientation cards, and that's all they do because it works.
Well, she said
and meanwhile, and, excuse me, yes. And meanwhile, this week, yes. The welcoming city ordinance that keeps cops in their cars and keeps illegal immigrant criminals, violent criminals in this country. Meanwhile, legislation she backed, as somebody who backed the Obama consent decree against the Chicago Police Department, that's how she made her public chops in this godforsaken city. Signed into law by Governor Pritzker, which also keeps police in their cars and makes that city less safe for those black people and frankly, Latino people and white people, all the people, regardless of your intersectionality score in Chicago, makes the city less safe. Cops will be in their cars because why would I get out? I can't get out to turn over anybody to the federal law enforcement, to help federal law enforcement. And I certainly can't get out to deal with any matters with respect to American citizens who reside in Chicago per the state and local disposition toward police. But hey,
and then Pritzker goes and celebrates conscious. It yesterday. The crime reform bill, let's celebrate. He went to Peoria, Champaign, and people actually were there celebrating with him. So out of touch are they, these neophyte politicians. They're one and done. They should be one and done, but I doubt it.
And so you understand what's happening to the city. I guess all you have to do is look around or talk to somebody who doesn't have a public sinecure. Pick a topic area as to quality of life, public safety,
sure.
K-12 education, economic opportunity, cost of living. How about city services, speaking of cost of living?
Garbage everywhere, Dan. It's disgusting.
A friend of mine emailed me this. Had coffee with a buddy who grew up and still lives on the same block in Old Town, right across from St. Michael's. Property taxes are north of $20,000. Actually, relatively low because nothing turns over on his block, so assessments have always been behind. His two boys went to Catholic high schools, so never used the public school system. Used to call the ward office when he was in need of a city service, but now there's no one to call anymore because they don't respond. No. Can't get parkway trees trimmed. 9 months ago he called. No one ever came out. Said he doesn't clear snow in his alley or down this block.
Please.
And now he feels he is not going to have much in the way of police protection after the legislation, both at the city and state level, that we're discussing. So your property taxes get you zero services. Oh, and by the way, that guy is a sophisticated attorney who was at one time in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. So he knows a little bit about the city. He's got a little bit of a longitudinal view about the city. He understands how it doesn't work and how it used to not work a little bit better and how now it doesn't work at all across any quality of life indice.
And another reason to sit in your car, there's a snitch line now because of this crime reform bill where you could just make an anonymous phone call, and it could be a personal vendetta you have against somebody. I mean, why would anyone be a cop in the state of Illinois, let alone Chicago?
Jim in Crown Point.
You know, this Rosanna Dana Rodriguez, I thought she was doing an imitation of Joe Biden. It always kills me. White people are always outraged for black people. Black people have a voice. When something's wrong, they can talk up. It's so condescending. It sounds like me when I'm talking to my 3-year-old granddaughter that makes a drawing and I'm fawning over it. It's garbage, but I'm trying to make her feel better. It's the same difference.
That's right. Thanks for the call, Jim. That's the whole play of the state and the status is to remove agency from those they've designated as their constituency. Shut up. We've got this.
Yeah.
Don't speak. We have this. Yeah. We're out, as Jim said, we're outraged for you. We've got this. We understand you're an infant. We understand you have no agency. And so we're going to treat you as that. You're going to be a ward of the state, making you a reliable supporter of us, and you just take what you get.
You just that's sounded why I say, like, yeah.
Well, that's why I say Lightfoot is smart enough to know this. That's why she bristles at it, and sometimes she lets the facade slip. But she's also complicit in perpetuating it, which makes her as culpable as the dumb socialists like Rosanna, Dana, Sanchez, Rodriguez.
I like
Rodriguez,
that.
Sanchez.
Whoever said Rosanna, Dana. Yeah, that's good.
Nice hat tip.
Nice, thank you.
Radner there.
Yes.
Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, good morning, guys. I want to talk about identitarian politics. I am a white 50-plus female. I'm handicapped. I had a job. I went back into the field that I had my career in when I was young. And I couldn't get one special accommodation for my handicap. I just needed to be moved from where I was sitting to another spot so I could do my job better. And they didn't do it. They wouldn't move me. And as a result, I couldn't do the job very well. And I lasted 4 months. This happened right before the pandemic hit. Lost my job, and there you go. Now I go on and try to figure it out myself.
Thanks, Mary
Where
Kay.
To work?
Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off, but I appreciate the call. Verlon in Westmont.
Oh, Verlon.
As a black man, I'm tired of being used as a scapegoat, the tip of a spear and a Spartan shield to get their agenda across. When will people just wake up and smell the coffee? I guess not. I guess not until this city, Chicago, that used to be a beautiful city, is totally, totally in the tank, in the hole, and just done with, you know, and discarded. But I hope one day people wake up and take this city back, but I'm losing hope for it.
Thanks for the call, Verlon.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Got questions? He always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity this afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about our local blue sewer.
Yeah.
Before the news, that would be Chicago. But there are others, blue state sewers, New York, California. It's interesting thinking about them as a group because they belong grouped together. Newsom is facing a recall election.
Fantastic.
The New York Post yesterday called for the impeachment of Nipple Rings Gambino.
Wait, why do you call him Nipple Rings?
Because he wears nipple rings.
Seriously?
Yeah, didn't you see the pictures of him from like late last year when he was in a white polo shirt? And it was good. This was like all the tabloid fodder back then. It appears that he wears nipple rings.
Gross.
Andrew Cuomo, yeah.
Nipple rings.
Nipple rings Gambino. They're calling for his impeachment. How come Pritzker?
Yeah, why does he skate?
Where's the reckoning from our governor?
The happy-go-lucky guy. I'm just happy.
New Yorkers and Californians are revolting against their respective governors because they're ruling class liars. What about our ruling class liar? How come he skates? And I do mean that only metaphorically because there's no way he could stay upright on skates. 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 64636DA turnkey.pro text line against the backdrop. By the way, the Sacramento Bee, an editorial out. The Sacramento Bee, this is not exactly a conservative outlet. No. Describing the Democrat corruption that is afflicting the state of California and saying, unfortunately, because there's Democrat supermajorities, nobody will listen to the Republicans. Wow. Wow. And what's the one of the lead stories locally today? more indictments yesterday. Eddie Acevedo and family, his two sons, because it's a family affair in Chicago. So when people ask you, does the mafia still exist in Chicago? You tell them, yes, we just call them state rep, state senator, alderman, mayor, governor these days. It still exists.
Ward bosses. Oh, yeah. They're there. And, but why can't we impeach Governor Pritzker? Because people ask all the time. They, you know, when I ask other people, they say, well, it's against the state's constitution.
Well, those people you're talking to are ignorant because, right. No, it's not, actually. There is a provision for impeachment, and here are the requirements. So tell your friends to
my
take notes.
Friends. So
15% signature requirement, 15% of the previous total ballots cast in the 15% of the total ballots cast in the previous gubernatorial election to get to the threshold of the state legislative requirement, which is you need 20 House members and 10 Senate members to sign on to the petition for impeachment. So you need 15% signatures of total ballots cast previous gubernatorial election. So in 2018, that was about 4.2 million. So you need 640,000 round numbers, 630,000 signatures.
Okay.
Then you need to get 20 state legislators in the House, 10 state legislators in the Senate to sign on. Here's the kicker. Only half can be from each party. You need five, you know, you need 10 and 10 and 5 and 5, Democrats and Republicans.
Or, yeah, 10 and 10, 5 and 5. Okay. And that's not going to happen.
And then if you get all those signatures and you get 10 and 10 in the House and 5 and 5 in the Senate, then you can put the question on the ballot and then a simple majority would impeach. So there's the process. Anybody taking that up?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Does anybody even know that exists? Does anybody?
I mean, we pay attention.
Of course not, because it's something people say to pretend like they're disgusted with it. Are they going to do anything about it here? No. Not only will they not undertake something as daunting as that, they'll continue voting the same way. They'll continue turning the blue collar counties even bluer, won't they? That's what we've done. So Newsom and Cuomo and then Pritzker. Honestly, he may be the only governor in America who is completely insulated from any performance review because the electorate says, we're not interested in a performance review. We don't care. That's what they say.
But also the mainstream media ignores him. I mean, it's always Cuomo, Newsom, Whitmer. They never talk about Pritzker, ever. And I don't
because
why?
Here's what here's
tell me why here, I think I know
he,
why.
Here's what Newsom was doing until he got caught with it, you know, at the laundry. And Cuomo did it to himself because his ego is so unchecked.
Right.
He had to make a daily spectacle of himself. And by the way, we know just how unchecked it is. We're starting to get a real clear picture based on some of these sexual harassment allegations that may actually push it over the top. The combination of Democrats turning on him over the fraud committed with respect to nursing home deaths during COVID, combined with the sexual harassment allegations against him, that may be a poisonous enough cocktail to end that Nipple Rings Gambino's political career. Wouldn't that be a happy occurrence? And by the way, I don't just want that. That federal investigation into the state's handling of COVID patients and nursing homes, I hope it results in indictments if there's something colorable under the law for which Cuomo can be prosecuted. Be nice to see a politician prosecuted for the sort of incompetence and deception that causes death for a change.
Well, Lindsay Boylan, the former aide, I mean, she said his inappropriate behavior toward women was an affirmation that he liked you, that you must be doing something right. They use intimidation to silence his critics and that he made sexual comments and advances to women in his office.
Yeah, let's play strip poker is one of the things he said. That he said to her, he kissed her on the mouth, she alleges, to congratulate her on the promotion she got. Mm-hmm. the reckoning here?
With this Me Too movement. Where is it now with Cuomo?
Well, it may be coming because he's losing allies on the left, but it may be coming only because he's losing allies on the left over his treatment of his erstwhile fellow travelers, combined with them seeking political cover from the fallout from the scandal that he has inflicted upon the state. So, you know, let's not start suggesting that Mayor Warren Wilhelm in New York City or some of those state assemblymen that are bitching about Cuomo's, you know, bullying of them these days are profiles in courage, because there's not, just as there are virtually no profiles in courage in this state. Well, but at least some of those people in California and in New York, residents and politicians alike, at least some of them have enough wherewithal to say, this doesn't work. Even in the socialist utopias we're trying to create here, this guy is just too much. It's too far. The reason, going back to your question about Pritzker, with respect to Newsom, with respect in comparison to Newsom, comparison to Cuomo, is that, you know, Pritzker is just a jolly old fella.
Mm-hmm. They don't take him seriously. I mean, he is never on a national platform. Rarely ever.
He's mastered to some extent. Mastered is probably too strong a word, but he takes the same approach that Sack of Durban takes. If I say unreasonable things in a reasonable tone of voice, then I'm a perfectly reasonable person doing reasonable things.
Well, and I really want to get this in, a courageous voice in all of this is meteorologist Janice Dean. She was with Ron Kim, that state legislator that was bullied by Cuomo yesterday. And what she said, she nailed it.
We had no idea there was a March 25th order to put over 9,000 COVID positive patients into nursing homes. I wish we had known that. And for 46 days, that mandate was in place until it was reversed and scrubbed off the health department website. And a lot of news agencies, news companies think that this is breaking news. We have been shouting from the rooftops for 10 months. 10 months. And I have yet to hear this governor say in front of a microphone, I am sorry for your loss. That would have been a good start. This is not about politics. It's not about Republican or Democrat. It's about what's right and what's wrong.
Because she lost both of her in-laws. They were in separate nursing homes, but they both died from COVID because of infected patients being sent back into nursing homes.
Do we ever get an accounting for the Pritzker policy of sending infected patients back into nursing homes in this state?
No. And I've asked and I've asked and I've asked, and like, oh, so tiresome. Why do you keep asking? And then the VA debacle happened.
Does it matter if somebody died in a nursing home versus dying in a hospital, you know, per Andy Cuomo, per Nipple Rings Gambino? Does it matter to you? I guess it doesn't matter in Illinois. It doesn't matter. Is there anything that a politician can do in this state, if they're a Democrat socialist, that bothers you? That bothers you enough to take your neighbors to task for supporting Democrat socialists in the suburbs that ensure Democrat social dominance of the state? I'm mainly talking the suburbs, because you know what? I got to tell you, among the many things that are exhausting about Illinois politics is suburbanites pretending that the problems in Illinois are all the city's fault.
Yep.
And frankly, downstaters too. If you think that, then you don't understand Illinois politics. I don't know how to break it to you. I guess I just did. Ray in Barrington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Hey, if you get a trigger for Pritzker, I'll go house to house to start to lead to get the petition going. But two things. He's, as far as I'm concerned, as bad as Cuomo. Illinois ranks 49th in second doses delivered. We came out of tied for 50th with Alabama 2 days ago.
We're coming for you, Mississippi. Yeah.
Well, I think we're 49th there, but the worst thing is Category 1B includes, on purpose, 25-year-olds, perfectly healthy, working remotely at home because they're associated with any manufacturer in Illinois. So a 25-year-old with nimble fingers on the computer is in an identical category as a 74-year-old with comorbidities and no computer skills.
I know. Mm-hmm. It's a mess. Never in America. That we should be handing out vaccines on age, not on occupation, not on what you do for a living. This is so stupid because we're not at risk. But yet, you know, and Ray, too, also, they're using the honor system. You could call up and say, oh, I care for my elderly mom. Okay, come in. What time do you want to come in today? It's a hot mess.
In-person index for K through 12 public schools by state. This analysis by Burbio, Community Data Service. Auditing 1,200 school districts of various sizes across the country. Last in the nation in terms of in-person schooling, Maryland. Second to last in the nation, California. And then also sort of in that category of 0 to 20% of schools in doing in-person is Oregon and Washington State. Mm-hmm. The next tier, 20 to 40% in-person.
Illinois.
Includes New Mexico, Nevada, Virginia, Illinois. New York is in a tier above Illinois.
Yeah. Because their parents protested. They cared.
And so again, is there anything that the political ruling class in this state, not just the city, the state, can do that would motivate suburbanites to think differently? The answer seems to be no. Keith and Kankakee, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I don't see Illinois changing. You've said it before, people just get comfortable enough. And I really feel it's a tale of two states. South by 80, personally, I don't feel like I've been touched by Chicago's corrupt politics yet. I do have a line drawn in the sand that I will move if it's crossed, but I don't know how you guys live at Cook and Lake, man. It's crazy, but there's no appetite down here to do anything because I just don't feel like it's touched me yet.
Well, Keith, in Kankakee, you'll recall that there was a former governor who then became a former federal inmate from Kankakee. So, I mean, it's not like it's, like I said, it's not like it's just a Chicagoland problem.
I understand. I'm speaking more, taxes. State taxes is the biggest thing. When I hear your guys' property taxes, it's outrageous. But it's funny, Governor Ryan, once he got out, man, him and his family, they rule Kankakee. You see him at a restaurant, it's like celebrity status, man.
Yeah, well, that's the sickness, isn't
right.
it? Thanks for the call, Keith. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Like, we don't have movie Hollywood stars here. We have politicians.
Our mob boss got out of prison. Look, he's back eating in one of our restaurants. Hooray.
Will you take a picture with me? Can I have your autograph? Yeah.
Jeff and Berwyn.
Greetings, Dan and Amy. Excuse me. Well, regarding Cuomo and these harassment charges, shouldn't the Me Too movement be out campaigning against him? After all, aren't all women supposed to be believed?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Hillary Clinton.
Thanks, Jeff. Greg and LaGrange.
Hi, good morning. First of all, this is absolutely right out of history. You have a bunch of apparatchiks that when they become useless, they get moved out. Just look at history. It's replete with examples like this. We don't have to go too far back, okay? Second thing about Pritzker and the city and the people of this state is that they've won. There is no place in this state that is immune from their power. They have won on every level. They have basically taken away law enforcement. They've taken away K-12 education. And when all of this nonsense is running rampant in the city, what's their solution? Let's have a vote on which statues to take down. You want to look at Rome at the end? This is Rome at the end. There's no accountability. There will never be accountability. And these people will continue to exist in their power structures until they see the end, and they will bail out before the entire door and roof comes crashing in.
Thanks for the call, Greg. I think that's right. And by the way, to his point about monuments, there is a monument review going on of more than 500 monuments in the city of Chicago. And there's legislation that duly elected Congressman Bobby Rush has filed seeking $150 million of federal taxpayer funds to replace Confederate era monuments.
And put up new monuments that they want.
That's the pressing issue of the day, the good legislator from Chicago.
But they want your input, too. It's 41 different statues and plaques throughout the city that I didn't even know were there.
500.
It's 500?
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, kicks off this weekend in Orlando, Florida, and President Trump scheduled to speak on Sunday.
Yeah.
What do you want him to say? What are you looking forward from President Trump on Sunday? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. You may not have known about it because you were looking for information on Twitter, and the CPAC conference Twitter account was accidentally, quote-unquote, suspended for a time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love how that happened. Somebody pressed the wrong button there, huh?
Right, one of the Twitter minders. If it was up to Liz Cheney, Congressman Cheney from Wyoming, there would be no Trump speech, but it's not up to her. It's up to CPAC. But she certainly was clear, not just with her vote, but at a presser yesterday with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, what her view is on Trump and his involvement in determining the future of the Republican Party. McCarthy was asked a simple question. Should Trump speak at CPAC? He gave one answer.
And she gave another.
Indeed.
Do you believe President Trump should be speaking, or former President Trump should be speaking at CPAC this weekend?
Yes, he should.
Congressman Cheney?
That's up to CPAC. I've been clear in my views about President Trump and the extent to which following January 6th, I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party or the country.
On that high note,
good times.
Yeah.
Trump shouldn't either be playing a role in the future of the party nor the country, is what Liz Cheney said.
312, yeah.
Should he address that on Sunday?
Yeah. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Should he address that comment that Liz Cheney made? Yeah. I mean, what is the future of the Republican Party and who's in charge? I mean, by all accounts, everyone keeps saying that this Sunday he's going to announce that he's running for president in 2024.
I doubt that. That would be the least interesting thing he could do. The most interesting thing he could do is offer some reflection on everything that's transpired since November. And a path forward, because elections and political leadership is about the future. It's about understanding the past to inform the future. And that would be the most interesting thing he could do. Now, it's interesting, speaking of interesting, the flip side of Liz Cheney, who doesn't seem to want to recognize the reality on the ground, maybe the reality on the ground will be inflicted upon her when the primary election rolls around in Wyoming in 2022. By contrast, Mitt Romney was on with the insufferable Andrew Ross Sorkin, this Deal Book DC policy project confab. And here's what Romney had to say about Trump, the future of the party, and Trump and the future of the party.
Will President Trump continue to play a role in my party? I'm sure he will. He has by far the largest voice and a big impact in my party. I don't know about his family members, whether they intend to do that, but I expect he will continue playing a role. I don't know if he'll run in 2024 or not, but if he does, I'm pretty sure he will win the nomination.
He would win the nomination?
Oh, I think he'd win the nomination if he runs. I mean, a lot can happen between now and 2024, so... And I'm not great at predicting. I subscribe to Yogi Berra's philosophy in that regard. He said, I don't like predicting, particularly if the future's involved. So I, I, uh, I don't really know what will happen there, but I look at the polls, and the polls show that among the names being floated as potential contenders in 2024, if you put President Trump in there among Republicans, he wins in a landslide.
Would you campaign against him?
I would not be voting for President Trump again. I haven't voted for him in the past, and I would probably be getting behind somebody who I thought more represented the tiny wing of the Republican Party that I represent.
And what wing is that?
The most interesting thing that Mitt Romney said there, and something that I would love Trump to pick up on and explain, perhaps Romney was intending to be self-effacing, but whether he was intending to be self-effacing or not, he was accurate in his description of the percentage of the party he represents, at least that being tiny, being an insular minority. And that's such an important concession by Romney, because the argument from the Vichy Republicans, the Nero Republicans, the surrender Republicans, is that you have to run to the center. We need to be a centrist party. We have to exile conservatives, certainly Trump supporters. And Mitt Romney just conceded, well, he represents a percentage of the party that doesn't win elections. Right. Something else Illinois hasn't been able to get its mind around for the better part of the last 50 years. Yeah, so we have to concede on these issues, and then and so that we can prepare ourselves to concede on more issues. Well, that gets you super minority status. Be great. I represent the tiny fraction of the party that I represent. Exactly. Why do you think that is, Mitt? Why do you think it is that you represent a tiny fraction of the party, Liz? I would love Trump to explore that question. Maybe it's because when Democrats propose $2 trillion in funny money spending, you propose $620 billion in funny money spending. When Democrats propose a $15 federal minimum wage, you propose a $10 federal minimum wage. Maybe it's because you're always playing junior partner to the Democrats, starting from their policy premises and just saying, let's go a little bit slower to the same destination. Maybe that's why it's a tiny fraction, because maybe there are enough Republicans, conservatives, even those who describe themselves as center right, even those who may not like Trump on a personal level, who actually have finally gotten wise to the problem of the, you know, to borrow my favorite description of this sort of Republican that Mitt Romney is, the kind of Republican that Malcolm Wallop described 25 years ago. If the Democrats proposed to burn down the U.S. Capitol, Republicans would compromise and agree to phase it in over 3 years. That's Mitt Romney. And that's Liz Cheney. You know, and that's Adam Kinzinger.
Right.
And that's
and
Fred Upton.
Challenger, and we'll have that challenger on at 8 a.m.
And that's so many of the Republicans that whatever you think about Trump's speech on January 6th and whatever you think about his conduct between the election and January 6th, it doesn't justify your useful idiocy in advance of socialists and their purge. It's not just socialists in terms of economic policy, the cultural purge that's going on. And that's what those Republicans are doing. David Marcus, great piece on Liz Cheney. Something else that she said that will go underappreciated and underreported. She essentially starts from the premise of the left, not just on matters economic, like Mitt Romney does, but on matters of caricaturing her own party. Caricaturing her own party how? Well, as white supremacists.
Oh, that's right.
David Marcus's piece at The Federalist, which you should read, I'll tweet out. Liz Cheney must explain why she thinks the GOP is a white supremacist party. It's very important, especially for us Republicans, to make clear that we aren't the party of white supremacy. You certainly saw anti-Semitism on January 6th. You saw the symbols of the Holocaust denial. You saw a Confederate flag being carried through the rotunda. We as Republicans in particular have a duty and an obligation to stand against that, to stand against insurrection. tell me how that is anything other than advancing the cartoonish caricature of Republicans and conservatives of, and of Trump voters, and that she knows that's how that rhetoric will be used by the left.
But doesn't she and Romney realize that President Trump brought more Republicans to the table, to this party? 75 million people voted for him.
And?
For a reason.
And?
Well, I mean, yeah, sometimes he's bombastic. I don't like his messaging sometimes. But think about what he accomplished while he was president.
Think about what the perspective of Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney is. You're asking the wrong question. Why would they ignore that? Why would Liz Cheney say the things that she said? That's the question you should be asking yourself. Why does Mitt Romney go on with Sorkin and say, you know, the tiny fraction of the party I represent, which is an accurate statement, whether he was trying to be funny or not. It's not inaccurate.
It's true. Yeah.
So why would he do that? Why would he not want to espouse the views of the majority of the party? Why would he not want to put in the fight for those 75 million people who voted for Trump? Why would he otherwise run cover for Never Trumpers who are basically enemies inside the perimeter of the Republican Party? I mean, in Illinois, you should know the answer very quickly because you've seen it play out with your state Republican Party, where enemies inside the perimeter represent the party leadership and destroy the party from within to the point of non-existence. But what price do they pay? What price have they paid in Illinois? It's a microcosm of what Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger represent at the federal level. Why is that? Why do you think that is? Liz Cheney would use the caricature of the left in describing her party. Mitt Romney would say, I represent a tiny fraction of the party, but that's not going to deter him from pursuing the same approach that he has pursued during his time in the Senate. Why? Don't you find it curious?
Tell us why.
Mark and Rochelle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, yeah. One thing I want to hear out of Trump is basically I want him to own January 6th. I want him to say something in the effect of, it is my fault that I did not make it clear that there was going to be dissenters, that there was going to be professional insiders, and that if anyone in that crowd saw anything, they needed to put a stop to it. And things like this happen over and over. They got to have countermeasures for countermeasures when it comes to this stuff. And the Democrats are a master at this. They probably have, you know, several levels of this in the works before anything happens. You know, what are your comments?
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Well, first of all, there were Trump supporters screaming to people, don't go in there. What is, you know, stop. What are you doing? They're trying to stop them, but the crowd was too big.
Trump did not incite an insurrection. And that's not me saying that. That's all the Democrats in the Senate now saying it after the impeachment vote. It was organized. It was planned. Wasn't that what they were saying at the hearing the other day in the Senate? Yes, it was.
Right. Well, because it was, and somebody planted two pipe bombs, not only at the RNC, but at the DNC.
So we've talked about this from the beginning.
Right.
You can't have a conspiracy that was incited sui generis by President Trump's speech. Those two things are mutually exclusive. So pick your argument and then present some evidence. So that's number one. Does that mean he couldn't have handled things on January 6th better? No, it certainly doesn't. He could have. Is that a defense for his tweeting, his speechifying about Pence and his tweeting about Pence? No, it is not. Is it a defense to how he and his team handled everything from the election day to January 6th? No, it is not. So, yes, it would be great. And Trump has shown that before, has demonstrated that before, something he doesn't demonstrate often, but he has before, some humility, some self-awareness. To say, yeah, I mean, I get that my personality rubs some people wrong. Maybe I don't always articulate things the best way. Maybe don't provide all the rhetorical context that should be provided in highly charged moments. I mean, some reflection, as I said at the outset, from him on Sunday, I think would be helpful. for him, for the party, for the nation. Things could have been done much better. The response could have been much better. And maybe he can provide actual additional context to the things he did do that have been reported but that are sort of lost in the muddle. Did he direct Mark Meadows to offer through the Department of Defense National Guard to Capitol Police? Maybe comment on what the testimony he heard this week at that Senate hearing about January 6th and provide some additional information to enlighten the situation. I agree with Mark from Rochelle that he should own it. I absolutely agree. Take responsibility for what happens on your watch and provide the additional information that informs people's understanding of it. Absolutely. Because otherwise you're going to let the left and Liz Cheney redefine January 6th into being something it was not and have that stick on the party in a way that is inaccurate and unfair, but it doesn't mean it won't happen. Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. 2 points. I think people like Mitt, or Republicans like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney, have seen a shift in society where it's slightly more liberal, and they're trying to get ahead and pander and cater to that crowd, and that's not what the Republican Party is about. Second, if Trump ended his CPAC speech, just start listing names, governors, senators, congressmen. Call out these weak Republicans. Call them out for what they are. They are not Republicans. They are Democrats who are pandering to a crowd, and they do not represent the Republican Party. Call them out. Get them out of office. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Clay. Dave in Wakanda.
Yes, I'd like to also add to what you said, Dan. President Trump needs to take ownership and clarify a lot of things. But I think also he needs to clarify all the things that have happened since the election, all the things that Joe Biden has done with all his executive orders, all the things that the news media is not saying. People don't listen to the news all the time, but a lot of people are going to tune into the president. So what he has to say will clarify a lot of things that have been going on in the country that are not reported by the news media.
Thanks for the call, Dave. I agree with that. I think he should focus on the sum and substance of what the Biden administration has done so far. That would be unifying in the way that, of course, being anti-Trump is unifying for the left. So I think that should be a central part of the speech. I think that's a good insight. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Get your tickets for Biden, the first 100 days on March 20th. Tickets are on sale now at 560theanswer.com/Biden.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. If you're a bit confused as to what the trajectory of COVID-19 is at present and what that means in terms of the way we live, then it's understandable. You have every reason to believe, to feel that way, because getting a lot of information that runs counter. Ashish Jha, who's the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, speaking to Joe Pinsker at The Atlantic, telling him that in a month or so, in the absence of a variant-driven surge, he, the dean of Brown University School of Public Health, would probably be comfortable going to a friend's house for a drink, mask-free and indoors, if he and his friend were both fully vaccinated. Quoting him, as we get into late spring, a lot of that stuff, the smaller gatherings of vaccinated people, I think starts becoming quite possible. Overall tenor of this Atlantic piece, though, where the staff writer interviewed a bunch of public health professionals like that gentleman from Brown University, was this: an uncertain spring, an amazing summer, a cautious fall and winter, and then finally in 2022, relief. Which is not inconsistent with what Tony Fauci has been proclaiming either, considering the advisory that we may be wearing masks and social distancing into 2022, that just because you're vaccinated doesn't mean you should be doing things like dining indoors, or going to movie theaters. That despite the fact that in some of the states that have had the most severe lockdowns, restaurants may not be at full capacity, but they're at 35 or 50% capacity. And yet, even if you've been vaccinated, you still shouldn't be going to eat indoors. Doesn't that strike one as curious? The lockdown then until 2022, until we have information that guarantees what we suspect to be true, that if you're vaccinated, you're unlikely to be spreading the virus. And then also understanding all of that in the context of the piece we talked about a bit earlier in the week in the Wall Street Journal by Dr. Marty Makary, who projects that based on the COVID case drop, based on a reasonable interpolation of those who have natural immunity combined with the population that has gotten infected and survived the infection, and then the 15% or so of Americans who've been vaccinated at present, with more vaccinations like the Johnson & Johnson single-shot vaccine coming online this week, that we're looking at herd immunity as soon as April. So we'd have herd immunity potentially on that timeline, but it's going to be a precarious spring and a hopeful rest of the year, but nothing clear until 2022?
We deserve our lives back. Our children deserve their lives back.
Well, who deserves what? I mean, I'm just trying to process the information in terms of what the science and the data tells us, since everybody has become so science and data obsessed. So what does the science and data tell us, and how should we be interpreting it? For example, this conversation we've had from the beginning. Should we continue to take the posture of those who were cheerleaders for lockdowns? Many still are, including schools, despite the mountains of evidence. Should we take the posture that we live life based on the worst case scenario, or we live our lives based on the most likely scenario? And so what does the science and data tell us about the most likely scenario, if that's the standard by which we should live our lives? For more on that, we're pleased to be joined now by the author of that piece in the journal I mentioned, Dr. Marty Makary, professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's the chief medical advisor to Sesame Care and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you guys.
So can you help us distill pieces that suggest that things are getting better, but don't expect anything resembling pre-COVID normalcy until 2022, with you suggesting we're tracking for herd immunity in April, and Tony Fauci saying we're wearing masks until then? You get the point.
Yeah, there's a lot of messages out there, and I think some of them are designed to calibrate expectations. I think there's some things that nobody knows. Nobody knows what the fall is going to look like. I think we're all cautious, but we're thinking of it as maybe what would normally look like a bad flu season. We'll see what the variants look like. You know, with the flu season, we're not very good at predicting. Some years the flu season is bad, much worse than we thought, and the vaccine doesn't work well. And other years it's mild and the vaccine works well. So I think right now people want to know, like, when can I get with my parents or the kids? When can they get some semblance of normalcy? And I do think that one trend that we're seeing in the data that the experts are not talking about is that natural immunity from prior infection is far more common than we thought, that there's a lot of people out there walking around with either antibodies or activated T cells, even if they don't have the antibodies. There's a study from Karolinska Institute in Sweden that shows you're twice as likely to have these activated T cells and be immune than you are to have just the antibodies. And we've based our prevalence studies on the antibody test. So it turns out probably one of the reasons for the massive 77% decline over the last month and a half is that a lot of people have some natural immunity from prior infection.
So if you get vaccinated, can you give COVID to others? That's a pressing question out there that everyone wants to know the answer to.
Yeah, I think it's highly unlikely. It's interesting. The old school medical establishment will tell you we don't have data on that. But we can also use common sense. We can use scientific inference and deductive reasoning. When you have less viral load in your system, when you're less likely to even get the infection, you're less likely to transmit it. And one of the studies came out last week that shows, yes, you do have a lower likelihood of transmission. In other words, we can feel kind of good about that. I think there's sometimes when we got to use common sense.
This common sense you speak of, I think we've become unfamiliar with the concept because, I mean, sort of as you're pointing out, yes, interestingly, unlike some of these TV doctors, can I speak with metaphysical certitude on it? No. Is it highly likely that this is the case? Yes. Is there research that indicates that it's more likely than not that this is the case, for example, on spreading after being vaccinated? Yes. But that's not good enough in some quarters. And it seems to me there needs to be more vociferous pushback to those who essentially seem to be arguing that we can't resume normalcy until there is zero COVID, which is an impossibility.
Well, I think we've lost sight of our goal. Our goal should be to maximize human health, health outcomes, and our livelihoods. It's not to extinguish the virus, because if we chase that thing, we're never going to win. And there are health consequences to some of the stuff that we call for. So look at the data points that no one has ever died after a vaccine has fully kicked in, okay? Take that data point. Take the fact that the trial results are really good and we're not getting the right messages, right? We're hearing, you know, yesterday on the J&J vaccine that it's, you know, 80-some% effective. Well, it's 100% effective in preventing COVID death, and it was 100% effective in preventing hospitalization from COVID once you get 4 weeks out from the vaccine. So let's put things in context and recognize the reality that people are dying of loneliness, that this is an epidemic problem, that substance abuse and mental illness and deferred medical care, kids are 10 times more likely to die of suicide than they are of coronavirus. And we've got to put things in context. I think to some degree we've lost our way.
We've lost our minds.
I think there's a bit of an addiction to fear, and perhaps this is something that Theodore Dalrymple aptly described as you know, frisson, this idea of overcoming something, feeling like you're in this fight and you're overcoming something that actually really doesn't present that much of a threat, and so there's sort of a thrill-seeking aspect to it. I don't want to play armchair psychologist, so I'll rely on him. But I also wanted to address something you addressed in your piece in the Wall Street Journal, because this is sort of the latest category of use to promote fear, and that is mutations of the virus. And we've seen this over the last several weeks now. You know, this mutation of the virus could soon be the most prevalent manifestation of COVID. This mutation of the virus may be vaccine resistance, and so on and so forth. And you addressed the variants in your piece.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of this, you know, the new variant. First of all, let's look at the track record of people who are saying this stuff. Okay, it's sort of like you're watching a financial analyst on CNBC or something, and you could see their average return for the prior year, right? And if they lost 15% consistently every year, you'd say, why am I listening to this? Look at the folks who said that. You know, the pandemic wasn't going to be a big deal. Don't wear a mask. We were going to have a surge upon a surge. Remember that after, you know, Memorial Day and Halloween and Thanksgiving,
and
that
we were going to see
the Super Bowl, right? And this was going to be the twindemic. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
The twindemic of the influenza and coronavirus colliding. Look at what folks have said. And what you realize here is that there is a bit of a pattern, exactly what you're saying, Dan. Now, I'll tell you, I'm taking the variants very seriously, but let's look at the data. In the UK, where the UK variant is dominant, that's the dominant strain, what's happening to cases there? They're down 84%.
in South Africa, where the South African strain is dominant, what's happening to cases there? They're down 90%. Brazil's a little more concerning. They're having a little more persistence with the P1 strain, but that's not the strain that anyone projects to be dominant in the U.S. And what's it mean if it's the dominant strain? If there's 5 cases a month or a day, it may not be a big public health threat if that's the dominant strain with a very low case number.
But then you have people like Bill Gates, not Dr. Bill Gates, who's up there saying, oh, you might need a third vaccination, which is a bunch of bull jive. Why are people even listening to him just because he has money? I mean, honestly. And then also now this morning they're talking about a California strain and a New York strain of the virus. So it's they're selling this fear, and it's the only way they can survive is if they keep scaring people into submission.
I've been following that California strain, Mary, and there's really zero data on it. They've not published a single thing on it. That was the opinion of the scientists that looked at it under the microscope. But you know, how much fear have we instilled? And look at all the media coverage on the California strain. Not a single report in the literature about it. So, you know, we got to take things in stride.
Yeah, I mean, common sense and track records of these are revolutionary ideas these days. I was at an event for the American Cancer Society, and they were giving a briefing to this, you know, donor class that was in attendance at the event. It was dominated by COVID. I mean, they started talking about the progress with respect to eradicating HPV and things that were actually cancer related. But then it sort of turned to COVID, and it was sort of dominated by COVID, even to the exclusion of talking about things that other medical professionals have talked about that have been really serious trade-offs that have been made, things like the sort of healthcare infrastructure to serve people with preventative cancer screenings, not to mention actually procedures, certainly at the front of the pandemic, and also the fear mongering that we're sort of talking about that has kept people who should be going for screenings, regular treatments, and so forth away from hospitals. I mean, this is the American Cancer Society. I just came away from that scratching my head, saying, How can somebody get so politicized, so lost in this, that they forget what the mission of their organization is?
Well, I think we have a society that's obsessed with laboratory pharmaceutical discoveries. And as someone who is a cancer surgeon by background, I spend most of my time in public health research now, but in that field of cancer, we spend $100 billion a year all on laboratories, never on the environmental exposures that could cause cancer, never on these concerning trends, never on food as medicine and how to take care of a person rather than just try to extinguish a cancer cell. And that is the society that we live in. That's why we got nailed on COVID, because we didn't spend any money on basic clinical research, bedside research that doctors needed to understand how many people are asymptomatic. Do masks work? Instead, we spent $60 billion last year on laboratory stuff. You know, give us a pill to fix our problems. Mm. And we need to do that stuff. I'm not downplaying it. And the vaccines were great. But why are we learning in July from Florida Atlantic University that a mask on a mannequin emitting green gas, if you remember those images that we got showing us the studies on? Why are we learning in July? Why are we learning that indoor gatherings is where it spreads in August? Why are we doing the studies on where people got COVID in September? And there's this vacuum that we left. And guess what happens in a highly opinionated country like ours? Opinions and just dominate and they move in. And so we forgot about basic bedside clinical research, and we spent all our money, you know, give us a pharmaceutical solution for everything. I think there's good news right now. People should be, you know, they should be. It's terrible to talk about good news when we hit a 500,000 milestone, but there's some good news on the horizon.
Dr. Marty Makary, professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Bloomberg School of Public Health, chief medical advisor to Sesame Care, and author of the award-winning The Price We Pay. Dr. Makary, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
Great. Good to be with you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Are we fractured as a country in an unprecedented way? You know, America's been through a lot. There are always divisions in the country. So is what we see in 2021 America so novel? Lance Morrow tried to tackle that issue in a Wall Street Journal piece, seeing red and feeling blue, about just exactly where the national mood is, something that commentators like to describe as if it's easy to apply one mood to 330 million people. It's not. And he gives some historical context, while historical context is still allowed, while we still recognize that we have, 2.5 hundred years of history. And he zeroes in on one thing that is different from the divisions of the past. Screens. And why don't we start there with Lance Morrow, who is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, essayist for Time magazine for many years. He's the author of the soon-to-be-released God and Mammon, Chronicles of American Money. Lance Morrow, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So when, we're trying to provide some perspective here as people are talking openly about, you know, the crack up of the Republic, we've been through a lot of trials and tribulations, a lot of dark periods in American history before. This is certainly one of them. But you suggest there is something, as I said, that is different, and that is screens, that is the digital universe. How does that make it different, and what do you think the implications are of that difference?
Well, I think the screens make it a lot more dangerous in many ways. The you can call it the democratization of information, but you can also call it the mobization of information. In other words, it is very the cancel phenomenon, the phenomenon of cancel culture and ganging up on these in these ideological attacks on people. Centered around race and gender, especially, this increases the intensity and the acceleration of these public moods. It concentrates them in a way that a magnifying glass will concentrate sunlight and cause a fire. I think it's hard to figure out exactly how dangerous things are now, but it seems to me that it's a very alarming business to see how quickly they're in this convergence of the pandemic and many other factors, the intensity and the one thing on top of another has produced a volatility, which I think is extremely unusual, and you'd have to go back to 1860 or something to but I do point out in the piece that as you said a minute ago that the country has always operated by binaries. Almost there's always been north and south and black and white and east and west and rural and urban and wet and dry and hawk and dove and so on. There all have always been these tremendous divisions. But now, as I say, because of the screens, it seems to me that we're in new territory, and particularly with the pandemic laid on top of everything else.
So how can you describe the mood of more than 200 million people?
Yeah, exactly. Well,
I point out, I mean, a long time ago at Time Magazine, I used to do a thing called the Mood of the Nation piece, and I always said when I sat down to write one of these things that it was ridiculous to think you could describe the mood of that many millions of people. But on the other hand, you have to bear in mind that, for example, on September the 12th of 2001, the mood of the country was very different from what it had been on September the 10th, 2001. And what had intervened, of course, was the attack on the towers in New York, which changed a great deal. So you can say certain things about mood. I think that it's safe to say about the mood now that it's certainly, people are in a very lousy mood, and they have a lot of reasons, good reasons, for being in a lousy mood. The economic consequences of the pandemic have been tremendous, and as well as the deaths, and then lay on top of that all of the divisions as between the woke and the obsession with race and gender on the one hand, and the people on the other side. So the mood, one thing you can say is that the mood is kind of volatile and changeable. In other words, if the sun were to come out, in a few months, and everybody feels that they're returning to normal, and the economy makes a good recovery, then the mood is obviously going to be better. But what I worry about is these obsessions, these woke obsessions with gender and race, and the divisions, and there is also the unknowable factor of Donald Trump and where he is going to go in terms of whether he's going to run in 2024 or whether he's going to undertake to be the leader of the Republican Party. His CPAC speech on Sunday is going to say a lot.
Well, I don't know. The Trump thing, I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, he's an instrumentality of the discord that you're otherwise describing, it seems to me. So maybe he can expedite some moment that he has the potential to do that. But that moment is going to come, because what we have is what we've had previously in America, and it's always been a catastrophe. We have a new racial order, and now we've expanded beyond race to other identitarian-driven orders, as you were sort of describing, gender, sexual orientation, and so forth. So we're compounding the errors that we've made in the past through things like slavery and Jim Crow. When you have the combination of corporate America, and that certainly includes big tech, which may be more powerful than the government, which is, I also think, a bit of a novelty in American history. Certainly,
yeah, that's a big factor. Yeah, you're absolutely right to mention that. That's a factor, a new factor that is very, very influential in our current situation.
Right, and those combined forces are allying to eliminate whiteness, among other agenda items. This is the new facade of the cultural Marxist. And that has to force a moment at some point.
Well, what do you mean by force a moment? I mean,
I don't know exactly what I mean.
By the way, I'm not quite, I think you may be downplaying Trump a little bit. I mean, he's still got a huge following, and that's he can tip the center of gravity in ways that I mean, you could have a 1912 situation. Remember 1912, the Bull Moose Party, Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft were against Woodrow Wilson, and Wilson won because Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moosers split the Republican vote. And, you could see that again in 2024 if Trump is the bull moose.
I agree with that. I mean, in terms of electoral outcomes. But what I'm saying is, and I think what I read from your piece is you're saying is that this is much bigger than a singular election. This is a cultural divide.
Absolutely.
And I mean, you reference, you know, you just to reference something from your piece. at worst, our tremendous mood will collide with one another. It was no use for Abraham Lincoln to appeal in his first inaugural to the mystic chords of memory, to a reverence for the history that Americans had in common. Too late, the country went ahead with civil war. I'm not suggesting that's inevitable here, but I'm suggesting it's possible.
Yeah, I'm amazed at the speed, the seeming speed with which there's been this tremendous disintegrative pattern. And you know, the civilization is a thin veneer, and democracy is a even thinner. And you know, people talk about, I mean, the possibilities of violence are very, one of the examples that I think of is the French religious wars in the 16th century, when the Huguenots and the Catholics were at each other's throats for, you know, 40 or 50 years. And it wasn't an organized big battlefront kind of civil war the way that the American Civil War was, but it was more skirmishes and outbreaks and an occasional massacre and so on. But there was a great deal of disorder, and the body politic was just split in a very terrible way, and it was a long time before that resolved itself. And I worry that the cultural difference in America is really huge. I mean, it's just the cobra and mongoose, and it's a two different species almost. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, I think that's what we're getting at. And you see it, you know, it was something to, you know, be shocked at, but sort of dismiss 30 years ago, 25 years ago when I was in college, what was happening at college campuses. Now it's in K-12. Now it's in corporate boardrooms. Now it's in all of our cultural and artistic and civic institutions. And, you know, you have seminars, whiteness is, basically being a thuggish jerk. And, look, what Frederick Douglass said, you know, I don't want to be part of a system that confers benefits and imposes responsibilities based on race, because somebody's going to be on the short end of that stick, and that's a powder keg. That's essentially the point that he made. That's the point that King made. And we're doing it again. It's just a different shape of a powder keg.
It's really shocking. And it's also the stupidity that's loose in this country. That's another factor that one should talk about. Stupidity is a very interesting subject. And there is a tremendous amount of sheer stupidity at work. And when you combine stupidity with ideology, you're really headed for terrible trouble.
It's a witch's brew.
And when you're talking about white fragility and white supremacy and all that stuff, there are, you know, obviously there is a problem with racism. But when you begin these bizarre doctrinaire ideological generalizations about white fragility and so on, it is very damaging.
And something else that seems a bit unique in American history, to the extent that it is occurring, is the elimination of American history.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the ignorance of American history is the canceling of American history. Not only American, you know, but Western civilization itself. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me that although I understand the motive, but you know, that people acquiesced in throwing out a couple thousand years of a very hard won intellectual accomplishment and scientific accomplishment and literary accomplishment, as Shakespeare and all the rest. That's incomprehensible to me, and yet I know the motive. The motive is to claim the slate and subdue the prevailing former culture and make it the former indeed, and replace it with something else. And be careful what you wish for.
Maybe
take down Abraham Lincoln and put up a statue of a BLM organizer.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. They want to take down four statues in Illinois of Abraham Lincoln.
Well, maybe Harvard University.
Unbelievable.
Maybe Harvard University epidemiologist Martin Kaldorf is right. You know, the Age of Enlightenment had a good run, 300 years or so, and now it's over. So there it is. Lance Morrow.
I don't think we should accept that. But.
No, I'm being facetious. God, I hope not.
Yes, I know.
Lance Morrow, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, essayist at Time for many years, the soon-to-be-released new book, God and Mammon, Chronicles of American Money. Lance Morrow, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Enjoy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, the Northwest Side GOP Club invites you to join them at their multi-candidate fundraiser, which is Friday, tomorrow night, Friday, February 27th, to support 7 GOP candidates that are advocates for change in Chicago. Don't give up. The fundraiser starts at 6 p.m. at Edelweiss German American Restaurant in Norwich. Tickets are $100. They include two drinks plus appetizers. There are options to direct your donations to specific candidates or to the NWS GOP Shared Fund. Find out all the details and secure your tickets for tomorrow night. NWSGOP.com. NWSGOP.com.
Welcome back to the show. And one of the reasons that blue states, deep blue states with deep blue big cities are such sewers is because the leadership that could come from outside of the political realm or that could hold those erstwhile ruling class politicians accountable decides instead to throw in with them, no matter how ridiculous their reigns are. And Chicago is ground zero for that. The latest piece of evidence I'd like to submit for your consideration. Dear Mayor Lightfoot, today Chicago, like cities across our nation, is at a crossroads. The pandemic, racial strife, and recession are a triple threat. Oh, interesting choice of phraseology, considering you're talking to the triple threat.
That's her line.
Right. I'm black, female, lesbian. That makes me a triple threat. Lori Lightfoot's value proposition as a candidate for mayor.
Mm-hmm. She likes it lesbian, female, black, by the way.
The pandemic, racial strife, and recession are a triple threat to our hometown. We commend you and your team for your steadfast leadership in navigating the city through the crisis. High marks for Lori Lightfoot and her team of socialist facilitators for their stewardship during the last 2 years. Is that what you would give Lori Lightfoot? High marks? While the task ahead is daunting, Chicago has a unique opportunity to rebuild in a way that ensures we emerge stronger, fairer, and more resilient. This is all on all hands on deck moment. No one can rebuild our beloved city alone. Only when our political leaders, the business community, civic groups, religious organizations, nonprofits, and cultural institutions join forces with a shared vision and effort, can we succeed. And what's that shared vision? So today, as business leaders responsible for employing thousands of Chicagoans, we're stepping up to stand with you and the Chicago Community Trust. We support Together We Rise for an Equitable and Just Recovery, the initiative you announced on October 8th to ensure an equitable and just recovery through financial and in-kind investments. And it's signed by a lot of Champagne socialists, to be fair, but also George McCaskey, chairman of Chicago Bears, Rocky Wirtz, Blackhawks, Jerry Reinsdorf over at the White Sox, Joe Mansueto, Chicago Fire. Did you hear that, John Cass? Many other CEOs. Again, many of them are champagne socialists who are otherwise doyens of the left anyway. But nonetheless, do you want to understand why? Why the decisions that are made? Why you can have failure perpetuated in spite of so many talented people, in spite of so many great institutions, or at least once great institutions? It's because, as they say in their letter, everybody throws in with the mayor, no matter how much of a cynical, identitarian, incompetent hack she is, and her socialist facilitators on the city council and in charge of so many of these institutions. And that's how you get the worst governed city in America in the worst governed state in American history. For more on blue state sewers, we're pleased to be joined again by Steve Malanga, who is at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor to City Journal. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
How are you?
Good. You've written recently on an aspect of these blue state sewers, as I term them, and that is with respect to infrastructure, something politicians like to carry on about and sometimes fall considerably short of delivering. So, for example, it is worth noting that Illinois, the transportation hub of the Midwest, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, gets grades like this for its bridges, roads, and transit. You know, our comparative advantage, transportation infrastructure, C's and D pluses, bridges, roads, and transit in terms of infrastructure vitality. And boy, you'd be shocked to hear that after Governor Pritzker doubled the state gas tax just a couple of years ago, and you've had intermittent multi-billion dollar infrastructure investment projects, shovel ready, so on and so forth. But it turns out these big blue states with big blue transportation systems are big money pits, Steve.
Yeah, actually, that's been an issue for a very long time. One of the things that struck me a couple of years ago was I was looking at a whole bunch of blue states that were talking about raising taxes as that kind of cycle got on. And at the same time, I was writing a piece on infrastructure, and there are all these, ratings of infrastructure quality that are done by, non-political groups like the engineers and so forth. And it struck me that the highest tax states that I was looking at also had the worst infrastructure in the country. And I said to myself, how is this possible? Not only that, but the best infrastructure rated were places like Texas and Florida, which don't even have an income tax. Tennessee, with very low rates. And it really boggles my mind. And, I actually eventually wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this, saying there seems to be no relationship between the high-tax blue state model and quality. And I went into a whole bunch of areas, not just infrastructure. I looked at things like education. I looked at things like housing affordability, inequality. People talk so much about inequality, and it's mostly progressives who talk about it, but the places that are most unequal are the progressive states that are taxing people the most in order to end inequality, according to their. So there's no actual parallel between high tax rates and quality of services. And you have to assume that that's because the high taxes are actually being, if you will, swallowed up by big government, not necessarily being put to effective uses.
And you wrote, too, in your article about 7 of the 8 states with the highest percentage of people who want to move elsewhere are solidly Democratic. And that Illinois is included in that, that's for sure.
And they're related. I'll give you an example. We did a poll a couple of months ago for residents of New asking residents of New York City, because, of course, of the impact of the pandemic there, whether they were intending to leave or not, or wanted to leave or not, and what was bothering them about the city beyond, obviously, the pandemic itself. And while we found a lot of people said they wanted to leave if they could, the most interesting thing was that they said what upset them the most was they weren't getting value for their taxes. Everybody knows that New York City is a high-tax place, and it's especially a high-tax place, of course, for wealthy people, although there are a lot of smaller taxes and fees that really chip away if you're even middle class. But the point was they felt they weren't getting value for money, and that is the issue. It's a little bit like going into, a Walmart or a Macy's or a Neiman Marcus, wherever you are on the economic scale. If you feel you're being fleece.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Right? It's a value. I mean, in retailing, they actually talk about value, the price-value equation. Well, in government, they don't talk about it a lot, and they assume people will just, go along. But clearly, the out-migration patterns show that people don't go along, that at some point they get upset and they leave.
Well, that's it. And actually, in Illinois, just to punctuate what you were saying, Jimmy John Liatu, the founder of the Jimmy John sandwich franchise, that's exactly what he said several years ago when he moved his corporate headquarters out of Illinois. And remember, his business started in Champaign, central Illinois,
Eastern.
To Florida. And he said, you know, look, I've been successful in life. I've done well. I'm happy to pay taxes. The thing that riles me about Illinois is the money I send to Springfield doesn't go where they say it's going to go. And there was somebody that was actually connecting inputs to outputs, which very few people do, including all of the so many of the corporate titans and other civic and institutional leaders. You know, Illinois has the highest combined state and local tax burden in the country, and yet you just heard the grades with respect to the state's infrastructure. We're one of the worst states in the nation when it comes to providing services to the developmentally disabled. We have some of the worst school systems in the country, starting in Chicago. So, I'm sorry, what is the return on my investment?
Well, and here's something else, okay? You asked this question, why are states that are collecting so much in taxes and always raising taxes, why are they ineffective? And I'll tell you something else that recently just came out. Just a couple of days ago, the University of Chicago, the University of Illinois at Chicago's Department of Political Science, every periodically they do a corruption index for the states. And they basically measure how many people have been indicted by the federal government by state. And if you look at the long term over the last 20 to 30 years, you know, Illinois is number one. California is number two. New York, the Southern District, Manhattan, is number three. So you have to think to yourselves, right? If you have governments that are persistently corrupt and they're collecting a lot of taxes, you know, maybe there's a relationship. Right, you look at the fact that it costs so much in some of these blue states to actually build infrastructure because they do things like pay off their political supporters with things like prevailing wage provisions and all these other things that drive up the cost. And so you look at the study that comes out just a couple of days ago, and you know the most corrupt places in terms of indictments of public officials are, you know, three blue, very, very blue areas. And so you have to wonder, is there a relationship between that and the fact that you have poorer services than you should be getting?
Well, that's what interesting, because the Sacramento Bee just recently opined on this, the Democrat political class corruption in California, and sort of lamenting, and this is the Sacramento Bee, which is, you know, not exactly a conservative outlet, lamenting that probably nobody will listen to Republicans in a state that's supermajority Democrat controlled. Yeah, well, maybe if the fourth estate wasn't also throwing in with the government for the past half century, maybe some more people would wake up and would listen. But that's precisely it. I say this all the time. When people ask, does the mafia still exist in Chicago? I say it sure does. It's just that in the 21st century, we call them alderman, state rep, state senator, governor, mayor.
Well, you know, there seems to be some kind of a relationship here. The most interesting thing, though, and I don't really know how to interpret this, is that as the Democratic Party moves more and more to the left, the people on the left are attacking, I guess, what you would call establishment Democratic corruption. For better or for worse, they're looking, of course, to replace that whole group. And so if we see what's going on in New York, where Governor Cuomo, who for years has been bulletproof because he could count on his allies in the Democratic Party. Suddenly, there are very left-of-center people up in Albany in places of power, and they're doing investigations. And now, every day, there's bad news about Cuomo. And suddenly, this guy went from being an Emmy Award winner for his, you know, press conferences on the pandemic to now they're trying to mount an impeachment of him. And, of course, Gavin Newsom in California is in a recall battle, and though it was started by a lot of Republicans and people on the right, people on the left are joining it, Democrats are joining it, and that's his problem right now. So there's a weird dynamic going on in America where both the right and the far left are saying, let's get rid of this, the establishment people who've run these places, and we're seeing some really, you know, a real political upheavals as a result of that.
Except in Illinois. Steve Malanga, Manhattan Institute, contributing editor, City Journal. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks, Steve. It was a pleasure. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump is speaking at CPAC this weekend in Orlando, Florida, on Sunday, to be specific. The question that was put to House Republican leadership at yesterday's presser was, should he be? Kevin McCarthy had one answer, Liz Cheney another.
Do you believe President Trump should be speaking, or former President Trump should be speaking at CPAC this weekend?
Yes, he should.
Congresswoman Cheney?
That's up to CPAC. I've been clear my views about President Trump and the extent to which following January 6th, I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party or the country.
On that high note, thank you all very much.
And I'm out.
So House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, yes, absolutely. Liz Cheney, President Trump should not have a role in the future of the party or the country. That is probably a view shared by many of those who voted with her to impeach President Trump in the House and the handful of senators that voted to convict him in the Senate. But it's certainly not the majority view in the party, as we'll no doubt see on Sunday. And it will play itself out in part, at least, in some congressional races where those Republicans who voted for impeachment and those Republicans who voted for a conviction may not only face censures from local Republican organizations, as so many have, they may face primary challenges. Well, here in Illinois, Adam Kinzinger in the 16th, he's been censured by the Will County Republican Party, by the LaSalle County Republican Party, and now he's got a primary challenge in the form of Catalina Lauf, who you may remember ran for Congress in 2020, this last cycle, a crowded primary to face Lauren Underwood. She narrowly lost to Jim Oberweiss in that primary for the nomination. But she outperformed, I think, everybody's expectations except perhaps her own. It was definitely an impressive insurgent candidacy for a first-time candidate. And she joins us now to talk about this latest undertaking. Catalina Lauf, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Tebow.
What has spurred you to this primary challenge of Kinzinger?
You know, it's exactly what you were just mentioning, the comments by Congresswoman Liz Cheney. You know, this is just, they are completely out of touch with the voters, the constituents. You know, what we saw in 2016 with the rise of President Trump when we made that referendum on getting away from the values of the old establishment, the big, you know, war hawks, the voting with Democrats, not standing firm on our values. And then, you know, within the last couple of years, we've seen the rise of the ultra far left because we haven't had strong people supporting our values, strong conservatives. And now you have people like Adam Kinzinger who are now going around prancing around MSNBC and CNN instead of being firm against President Joe Biden, being firm against the far left. He's basically become one of them. And, you know, I don't mind him being in politics, but he might as well change to become a Democrat because he's not representing the values of Northern Illinois anymore.
That's
and
nice.
It's time that we... go ahead.
No, sorry. That's what I was thinking too. Why not just join that party or be a full-time CNN contributor? Because he seems to care more about his national airtime than he does his constituents.
Absolutely. Over the last summer, things like BLM, all the riots that happened that affected the suburbs, the COVID-19 response. This is not just about impeaching President Trump for the second time, which was a complete circus the first time. Then the American people had to go through it again on a phony impeachment hoax. It's not just about that. It's the fact that if you want to be a leader, if you want to be elected in Congress, you should be the voice of thousands of people who in your party who supported you and represent the district as a whole. That district, Illinois 16, is a Republican district at heart. It's time that it has accurate representation.
And it seems to me, you know, you can like or dislike President Trump. And it seems to me the real offense that Kinzinger and Cheney and some others have committed is adopting the left's caricature of the Republican Party writ large and Trump voters writ large. It's one thing to say I disagree with how he handled things on January 6th. It's another. I disagree with some of his rhetorical choices. I disagree with him on some policy issues. Fine. There's room for disagreement, of course. It's another thing to say we're not the party of white supremacy. Well, who's saying we are? This is how the Illinois Republican Party does it, is defines itself in the negative. I'm going to spend all my time telling you what I'm not based on what I'm illegitimately being accused of being. And Kinzinger's response to all this is, oh, we need to, you know, shut down the outrage machine. And yet he goes on CNN and sits idly by while Anderson Cooper compares what happened on January 6th to the Rwandan genocide, for goodness sake. So, you know, the all of this talk of principle is not only adopting the caricature of the party that the left promotes, but it's also projecting onto themselves what they wish they had, which is a principled position.
You're absolutely right, and very well said there, Dan, because what it comes down to is ultimately, you know, there are still 75 million plus people who, you know, we're upset. I mean, the last 6 months, even the last 4 years, have been a complete circus in Congress. Now everything that's happening with COVID-19, the whole presidential Biden, the campaign leading up to the inauguration, I mean, people are upset. There are legitimate questions that need to be answered. There are legitimate concerns with what President Biden and Kamala Harris want to push now, and who is fighting for what is right on the Republican conservative side. When we have weak Republicans and the establishment, that is the problem. And it's time that we, you know, we have the voices of the majority of the party. We are more united as a party now more than ever. And our fight is with the far left, the socialists. Let's try to, you know, get together now, get rid of these minority voices in the party, which are the Liz Cheneys and the Adam Kinzingers and Mitt Romneys in the Senate, and understand that our country in the Republican Party is moving on the America First agenda. And it's the most inclusive agenda. I'm the daughter of somebody who came here from Latin America to pursue the American dream, that we made so many gains in all different demographics with the America First agenda. President Trump did well in so many different areas that historically, Republicans do not. And we need to capture the essence of that in new leadership, and especially here in Illinois, because we are losing our ground here.
What did you make of when Adam Kinzinger went on, gave an interview to the New York Times and handed them a letter that his family had written him, saying how disappointed that they were in him? It just seems so like the victimhood, you know, look at me, even my family hates me.
Of course. And he clearly loves the attention and loves the spotlight, which is also another issue. You know, he started that PAC. It's been funded by Bill and Melinda Gates. I mean, this has become just the Adam show. He went to D.C., forgot where he came from, forgot the roots, and is clearly, again, like you mentioned, Amy, you know, angling for an MSNBC or CNN contributorship. And if that's what ultimately he wants to do, then he might as well go do it and allow somebody out here who actually wants to fight for the people here in the Illinois 16th district and in Illinois. Frankly, we need better leadership all across the board. The Democrats are making gains all around here. They're flipping seats like what happened in Illinois 14 with Lauren Underwood, and they're one by one turning this state more blue than it could possibly be. It's time that we hold the line. It really is. And we have adults in the room that want to make change.
You mentioned about the representation of the 16th district, which is a pretty rock solid Republican district still. And so this is not just a referendum on Trump or his impeachment vote. It's also a referendum on his record over the past 10 years. And recently, I mean, if you go look at, for example, the American Conservative Union's rankings by vote on substantive issues that implicate conservative philosophy and policymaking, you know, Kinzinger is at 60%, and he's been lower in years past. You know, that is not conservative leadership. That's muddled at best, and particularly when you have so much profligate spending and so much expansion of government, and frankly, Kinzinger has been completely absent with respect to the advance of cultural Marxists in big tech and in every other institution. So, you know, beyond Trump even, what exactly is the value you're getting from Adam Kinzinger? It seems to me is a question that needs to be put to GOP voters in that district.
You're absolutely right. And his voting from a defense perspective, I mean, we are still in a 20-year war. And he's voted consistently with, you know, globalist war hawks and things like that. I mean, looking at our international footprint, you know, voting on these very these policies that are completely taking away from what we are here in terms of work, manufacturing, you know, a lot of the area. I mean, you look at Rockford, you look at even places out here in the northern suburbs. I mean, we are hurting. Small businesses are hurting. And we need better leadership when it comes to providing economic opportunity, making things work for the American worker out here, being more creative and more innovative from a pro-growth perspective, but also standing up to the globalists, standing up to the cultural Marxism. I mean, we're fighting these ideologies from all different angles, and we need lions in Congress. We truly do. And we cannot afford as a country to have people like Adam just playing these lines back and forth. It's not helpful for constituents, and it's not helpful for the overall message of the Republican Party.
Well, and what you see in states that are dying, like Illinois too, that are dominated by the left, is a Republican Party that's essentially surrendered, and it's the men and women of always. And I think this is one of the reasons why your candidacy in 2020 got some traction, I think, that surprised many, which is there's a desire among the rank and file, the base, those without titles, to usher in a new generation of leadership in addition to a new attitude.
Absolutely. And thank you. And that's exactly what we're trying to accomplish, not only for millennials, but for being able to expand the party base. A lot of the time, it's just the Illinois Republicans have been so absent here there's so much work that needs to be done on a grassroots perspective. There are people that are excited and want to be involved, and even more so now because they're watching the news. They see what's happening, and people are waking up. But we need an infrastructure that is going to be able to organize and get the message out there and really push back in a way that we haven't before. There is hope in this state. There is always hope. And we just need to encourage people to be able to use their voice, use their activism and their platforms to be able to push back on this that's happening. So I'm really looking forward to being able to be that on a national scale with the platform that I've built over the last a couple years on not being afraid to fight against the far left, but also being able to work for actual change here on a grassroots perspective, because people's voices are not being heard right now, and they deserve to be heard. People deserve to be listened to here in Illinois, and I think we can make a lot of gains here as the Democrats become more radical.
Do you think you're able to, or have you been able to sort of consolidate the support of those who are upset with Kinzinger, Republicans, I mean, including the organizations, such that it will be Catalina Lau versus Kinzinger? Because it seems to me that's what you want. The more crowded the primary, the more that benefits Kinzinger.
Absolutely. No, you're spot on. And I think, you know, over the campaign has just begun, right? I think over the course of the next few months, we'll see that there are clear, serious candidates, and like there's a one clear, serious candidate, and it is very much Catalina against Adam. And at the end of the day, you know, there are opportunities not just to be against Adam, but also to be able to grow the base in a way that Republicans in the past have not been able to. Ultimately, people on both sides of the aisle get very frustrated when they vote for somebody and then they go to Washington and then they forget where they came from. A big push of mine is term limits. I mean, for the last decades, we've been lied to about, oh, we'll push term limits. That's never been beneficial to folks on either side of the aisle. But I believe with new representation, people that are not afraid to back down and have voices, we can actually accomplish things like that. There is no need for people to go out to Washington, forget where they came from, not work for their constituents, That we've had enough of that. And that is a frustration on both sides of the aisle, frankly.
And Catalina, I love your announcement video. And they should follow you on Twitter, Catalina Lauf, yes. L-A-U-F. You've got 5,666 views so far. So good job.
Yes. Thank you very much.
And other...
Catalina,
sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Got other contact info for the campaign.
Yep. CatalinaForCongress.com and just Catalina Lauf on all social media platforms.
Catalina Lauf, Republican candidate for the 16th Congressional District come next year. Catalina, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Have a great day.
Yep. You too. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we continue to try to profile particular school boards that feature particular individuals that should be instructive to you about your schools, about why things are happening that you don't understand or that you can't believe are occurring, whether it's just getting back to school or it's the curriculum or it's the attitude that you get from some school board members and some administrators and some teachers.
Yeah, they think they're
the teachers' unions.
Don't they think they're God?
What their agenda really is and who they think is in charge of your children. It's instructive. I think the latest example comes from La Mesa Spring Valley School Board, another California example. And remember, this is against the backdrop of California being worst in the nation, only to Maryland in the percentage of schools that are doing in-person instruction as we sit here almost in March, almost more than a year later. La Mesa Spring Valley School Board, they're voting on a reopening plan. This is the topic for this Zoom school board meeting they're doing that you'll hear. And a voice of cognitive dissonance with respect to even considering the reopening plan, even considering it, is the vice president of the school board. Her name is Sharda Bell Fontenot. She describes herself as a black feminista.
Oh, please. What is that?
You'll hear.
Okay.
And I know that what we're doing is wrong. So how are we forcing people? That seems like a very white supremacist ideology to force people to comply with, you know, a conform. Just letting them. Privilege. Check it, you guys. Matt, so I don't want to be a part of forcing anybody to do anything they don't want to do. That's what slavery is. I'm not going to be a part of it. Like, nobody even knows, none of you guys even know what we're talking about right now. This seems like a mess. We should not be voting on this tonight. You guys don't have all the information that you need. You guys are just saying what you're speaking from your heart, and that's fine.
What more information do we need? The information is there. Schools should be open at every level, K through 12.
Yeah. I'm not going to force anybody to do anything they don't want to do. Oh, really?
Well, you're forcing us to do things we don't want to do, right,
Dan? I wish there would have been some pushback from the fellow school board members. Most of them are too afraid, although one... I think the superintendent did speak up against some of her characterizations of her fellow board members not knowing what they were talking about. Really, the whole premise of government schooling is forcing people to do something they may or may not want to do, like put their children in your charge for 8 hours a day, right? For 12 years of their life. Isn't that right? That's a law, compulsory attendance. Isn't that a law? Is that forcing somebody to do something, Ms. Fontenot? Of course it is. Bunch of silliness. Forcing people to do something they don't want to do. Well, here's how this works in an employer-employee situation, even in the public sector, and even with a collective bargaining unit and a contractual relationship. The terms of employment are laid out, and we're in an executive position. We have a fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers we serve, and so we make decisions about how our institution is going to operate, and we abide the terms of contracts we sign because they're legally binding, and so that's what we're doing, Ms. Fontenot. And of course, that wasn't explained, and it should have been. And this went on. So then she got into a back and forth with the superintendent, who suggested that she shouldn't essentially be saying people don't know what they're talking about. I believe the school board chairman interceded. And this is how that, you're suggesting, hey, you know, why don't you take that offline and leave it to be a private conversation?
Oh,
and then, as you might anticipate, what happens next after somebody who's already invoked a slavery comparison to teaching, here's what she said.
I think this should be a private conversation between.
No, it doesn't need to be private. None of this needs to be private. Racism doesn't need to be private, Becky.
Racism doesn't need to be private, Becky. It's racist to send children to reopen the schools and send children back to school, have the teachers go back to teaching. That's racist. That's white privilege. That's racist. That is on the path, if not already at the destination of slavery. This is the position.
And they can't teach from the grave. But remember that tweet that the CTU sent out, that it's misogynistic and racist to even talk about reopening schools.
Correct. This is the Pat line.
312. Yeah, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Which is why, by the way, this Pat line of, I don't really have a substantive defense of my position, so I just invoke race or some other identitarian category. And that's why I so enjoyed this exchange yesterday between Lori Lightfoot and a Democrat socialist alderman. She identifies with the Democrat Socialists of America. 33rd Ward Alderman Rosanna Dana Sanchez Rodriguez. Rodriguez Sanchez, excuse me.
She's always going to be Rosanna Dana, you know?
Rosanna Dana Rodriguez Sanchez. Talking about, you know, all the contributions of black people, you know, focusing on offering
it's Black History Month.
Offering one upmanship with respect to who cares about black people the most. And so Rosanna Dana Rodriguez Sanchez offered this, and she got a terse reply from Lori Lightfoot.
I really hope that as lawmakers and people committed to transformation, we will be able to continue to fight for a more equitable, a more just, a more a space where we can all be free, a space where black people feel safe, a space where we can all thrive, and that starts with the liberation of black people. Until that happens, none of us will be free. I'm very grateful for the contributions of all black people that have come before. And I'm really thankful for all my colleagues and all the black people that have contributed to make this city a better place for all. Thank you, madam.
You gotta be f-ing kidding me. Thank you, Alderwoman. The chair recognizes Alderman Jim Garden.
Yeah.
She claims that sorry to disappoint Twitter trolls, but my comment had nothing to do with Sanchez. But she wouldn't say what she was referring to, which makes me think that she was referring to what Sanchez was saying.
Yeah, you got to be effing kidding me. No, I mean, again, I understand how exhausting it is to listen to some dum-dum prattle on with identitarian claptrap, you know, like the mayor does when she describes herself as a triple threat because she's a black female lesbian. But it's interesting. Lightfoot doesn't actually buy this rap. She just uses it cynically for political expediency's purposes. Now, we did get some exclusive audio of the follow-up to that exchange after the "you got to be effing kidding me." It continued with Rosanna Dana Sanchez Rodriguez wanting to continue to express her love of black people.
I love black people!
I love black people!
Who's your mother, Jerry?
You, my mother!
What you gonna do, Jerry?
Show me the money!
Yeah,
that's so awesome.
I don't know why the mayor was referred to as Jerry, but maybe that's an inside joke. Harry in Las Cruces, New Mexico. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I'm previously from Hawthorne Woods. I made the jump to hyperspace and got the hell out of Illinois. But
smart.
It was like I had no choice at that point. I said, this is enough. But the point I wanted to make is people don't seem to understand the difference between socialism and how it impedes freedom. They think a little bit of socialism is okay and there's nothing wrong with that, mixed with capitalism, when in fact it eventually takes over capitalism. And that's why we're in the situation we're in now. There's essentially very little difference between socialism, communism, fascism, Nazism, Marxism, Maoism. Those are all forms of collectivism. And people not understanding the difference between collectivism and individualism is very basic problem, I think, that could be solved, by having programs on it or letting people understand the basic philosophy behind government. These people don't seem to understand the difference between freedom and lawlessness, nor do they understand the difference between success and thievery. And that's basic economic ignorance. They think that if you were successful, that you somehow must have taken it away from somebody else. And these are relatively easy things to explain. You know, they have to understand what money is. Money isn't just something the government prints and gives you to use. It's basically frozen productivity. And if it's reflective of the amount of productivity in society, then that's good. If it's not, if there's way more money than productivity, that's inflation. And it becomes worthless.
Yeah, thanks for the call here. I mean, you're absolutely right that all of these schools of collectivism converge on the road to serfdom. And that's sort of the foundational understanding that needs to be driven so that you can get to some of these other topic areas like a crash course in economics. I completely agree. But there's no room for teaching math or even ethno-mathematics when it's all identitarian politics all the time. In point of fact, that's how math becomes ethno-mathematics. It's a problem. Terry in Rogers Park.
Hey, I'd like to know if e-learning teachers are still telling children how immoral they think white America's history is. They probably eliminated that curriculum for now, so parents won't see on screen that what they're teaching is degrading the white children.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Dave in Bolingbrook.
Yeah. Did you guys hear about this new law in the state of Illinois? It was not publicized very well because they didn't want it to. But this comes from the Thomas More Society, who found it out anyway, what's going on. The Culturally Responsive Teaching and Leading Standards Bill.
Yeah, we've talked about it intermittently for about the last 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I guess it passed on a...
Of course it did. It passed out of JCAR, passed out of the administrative committee. Yeah, of course.
Right.
Like the anti-police measure that Jelly Belly signed on Monday. It's going to move. I mean, who do you think's in charge? But go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm just.
Well, I was just going to say many of us would leave right now if we didn't have children or grandchildren in school, especially our grandchildren. Because our kids are going to be able to tell the teachers what the truth is.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Dave. Appreciate it. Mike and Lyons.
Good morning. Listen, I'm going to switch gears for a second, if you don't mind. And so we get attacked from every side, right? Big tech, you name it. We all understand conservative, the aggression against conservatives. But here's a golden opportunity, and I think we're missing it. Bank of America shipped all our information, those of us who went to Washington for the 5th and the 6th, right? That's a pretty well-known fact among conservatives, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that we're not taking out every single penny out of the Bank of America from us as conservatives and talking about it. Because how many times have you heard somebody say, oh, if the Democrats, if we did that to the Democrats, boy, they'd be doing this. We're always under attack. Why aren't we taking the offensive when we can? Because we don't.
Thanks for the call, Mike. I mean, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. I mean, the boycotting businesses, maybe that's not the best approach for conservatives. It's not an approach they favor when I say the best approach. The left, more beholden to groupthink. Perhaps that's an easier path for the left. But the more general point about being on offense where you live, within areas that you can influence, your local government, your school board, your school, the local philanthropic groups that you're associated with, church. Yeah, why aren't we on the offense? Great question. John in Grays Lake.
Good morning. Hey, I wanted to pick up on the conversation you had before 8 o'clock about how the inefficiencies of blue state governments should be in the data there somewhere. We need to turn that into, actionable messaging for, people in minority communities and so on about how they're getting ripped off. If we're spending $1 million per mile versus $500,000, in a red state, how that is wasting the resources that is being given to blue state governments, and how that is a form of systematic racism. And,
okay.
Harry was right about collectivism, but yawn. I mean, that's not going to grab any.
And it's not.
That's not
going to
change any minds of the people who are against conservatives right now.
Thanks for the call, John. Sean in Elmwood Park.
I love the Lori Lightfoot. That's two things we agree on. I like boxer briefs too, except I can use the fly, Lori. Number two, it is ridiculous when you hear some moron pandering to you. It is. They are kidding you, by the way, stupid. And you love it. It was fun to catch her in a moment of honesty. I think that was great. As for the Bank of America guy, does he not understand? It's the government. There is no Bank of America. Those days are over. Everything is quasi-government. They took over all banking. So go ahead, take your money out, and wherever you put it, it's the same thing. So we need to wake up a little bit. As for the econ professor that called you, does he not know your name? Your dog's name is Hayek? Your dog could do a better explanation of collectivism. We all know that. It's too late. The cancer metastasized. So it's over with. And Prof, cheer up. I don't like the tone of your voice. I'm going to be filling in tomorrow. I don't need the humdrum. Yeah, I know it, Prof. I want the optimistic. Life is good. We're in sunny Florida, not a cloud in the sky. I look like George Hamilton. Cheer up.
Thanks for the call, Sean. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.